Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, one of the nicest dudes I met way back when I was a little kid and cool the whole way through. Probably, I'm being honest, probably the nicest guy in his band, in my experience. Eric Sandin of the band NoFX, a.k.a. Smelly. And he is here in celebration of the release of a brand new NoFX record. That's right. It's kind of like a NoFX week here. We have two episodes. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me, and we can communicate that way. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. If you want to get in touch with me more directly, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Left4Damien. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is just by telling everyone you know about it, letting everyone you know that we do this podcast here and that we have all sorts of guests just BSing about punk rock. You can also support the show by subscribing to it and rating it on your platform of choice, or by heading over to patreon.com/turnitapunk. Thank you to all the fine folks that do that. Your support keeps this thing going. And speaking of support, keeping this thing going, thank you to the fine folks at Vans who came aboard a few years ago and said, Damien, do what you do. We just want to help you cover the costs. You don't have to do it in your own pocket. And they have. And they really helped me kind of cover the expenses around here, which there are some. You know, you go figure. You do a free podcast, people complain about it, and then it costs you money. Well, Vans didn't think that was right. They said, you know what? We will help it not cost you money. We can't take care of the other stuff, but we can help it not cost you out of your own pocket. And so thank you to them for that. Okay, on to today's show. Today on the show, it's a big one. It's kind of like a two episode arc, I guess, because it is NoFX week here on Turned Out a Punk, because NoFX has a brand new album called Single Album, and that will be out in stores at the end of February. It was just announced there's a brand new single called Linoleum, which is a great song and a kickoff to what should be a very interesting record. They're promising this is the most introspective album to date. And I'm excited. NoFX is a massive influence on myself, on the band I play in Fucked Up. You know, like, they're a band that I've loved for a long time. And way back when I was like 14 years old, I must have been 15. 15 years old, I tried to do a fanzine. It was going to be called Drunken Box Kicking. I was going to do it with my brother. We were going to do it with our friend Ted Moore. Josh Bricker was involved. I'm trying to remember who else was involved. Michael Kai, I believe, was in there. Will Sachs. Josh Kirschenblatt. I don't know why I'm telling you all these names. These names don't mean anything. But shout out to all these people if they're listening. I haven't spoken to some of them in years. But we're going to do the zine. It was going to be awesome. And so we went out to the Warped Tour, and we had our sights set on all these bands that we wanted to interview, only to find out it's a lot harder to interview the bands at a big festival like that than it is at a normal kind of smaller DIY show. But somehow Tristan ends up meeting Smelly. And next thing I know, we're being taken backstage and we're sitting down and we're talking to him, and he was just so cool to us. Like, just out of anyone we talked to while making this zine, he was, you know, just the chillest. Like, it was just so awesome. And then, you know, fast forward years later and I'm playing on festivals with NoFX and he's still cool. He's still that guy. And, yeah, I've always wanted to sit down and talk to him. And this is a really fun episode. We do touch on some heavy stuff. If you have not heard the NoFX audiobook or if you've not read the NoFX book, I promise you, even if you're not a fan of NoFX's music, this book will blow your mind. It is this and Shane Carter's book, which I'll be getting to in a few weeks. But those two books are my two, I don't know, like, favorites. Such a weird word to use to describe this book because it is so harrowing to read, but I strongly recommend reading it or listen to the audiobook. The audiobook's fantastic. Jello Biafra's there. Tommy Chong's on it too, but strongly recommend listening to that. This is a good companion piece to that one. But that's it. I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back and enjoy Eric Smelly Sandin on Turned Out a Punk. Eric, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Why, you know, I got to say, you are the sexiest man that I've ever seen on the cover of Spin Magazine.
Oh, well, that
That makes me blush. Once again, I'm really glad this is a audio podcast, not a video podcast. I very much appreciate it. Also, I got to say, years ago at the Warped Tour 1996, you were the coolest person ever and granted my brother and I an interview for our fanzine that actually never came out. Sorry about that. But you were awesome. Awesome to us.
Well, I don't remember, but I'm glad I granted you guys something that didn't come to fruition.
Well, you definitely made our experience at the Warped Tour that day. And it was a, I was talking to my brother just before I came on to do this. And he was like, God, do you remember how cool he was to us at that thing? And I was like,
All right, well, how about this then? Judging from your past track record, is this interview right now going to be a waste of time? Is it going to come out?
Oh my God, you better believe I'm going to rush this one. This isn't going to sit on the shelf very long, my friend. It's going to be pretty fresh. There's a lot of stuff. Like I listened to the audiobook. Like, we were supposed to do this a few months ago, and it just didn't come to fruition. But like, I listened to the audiobook then, and I was just making all these notes. And so I have all my notes close at hand, and I'm ready to dive in. Cause like, you know, you talk about it briefly, but let's nerd out a little bit about Mystic Records and Caustic Cause and that whole world. But I got to start this off, Eric, which is the way I start them all off, which is, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Well, yeah, the first time, I mean, I remember being a kid, like, I don't know, in the, probably like 77 or something like that. And I saw the band The Tubes on TV, like they're like an old, like late night. I think there was this thing called Don Kirshner's Rock Concert or something like that.
Yeah.
And the tubes were playing, and they weren't really punk per se, but they were definitely not rock and roll. They were more kind of like new wave-ish, different, artsy fartsy. And I was like, oh shit, that's kind of cool. That's kind of cool. Kind of weird, you know, but I was like 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And then a couple years later, I was looking through a magazine, and I can't remember which publication it was, like if it was Time or People or Cream Magazine or some magazine, and I saw a picture of the Dead Boys, and I didn't know what they were, and all I knew is that they were a band, and it was like a promo shot. It looked like maybe it had taken like right after a show or something. They were all sweaty and disheveled and just scary looking, man. Mm-hmm. Just fucking eerie. And it caught my attention. It really did, because, you know, you're used to seeing like rock guys and musicians kind of pretty and kind of, you know, just looking the part. And this was something completely dark and edgy. And that's kind of like how my life was growing up, kind of just dark and heavy and kind of weird. And so it spoke to me in a weird way. And then shortly thereafterwards, I don't know, within a year or two, I don't remember exactly, I was at a swap meet and I came across a Dead Boys cassette, and I stole the cassette and gave it a listen, and it fucking, now we're talking. That's what got me into punk rock. I lived in this little suburb of LA about 20 minutes from Hollywood, but no one was into punk rock. No one. And I was like this lone little guy, just forging my way through it and just figuring it out and diving into it. And fuck, dude, it changed my fucking life.
Well, and where did you kind of go from getting this Dead Boys cassette? Like, was there, you know, as you said, you're the only one kind of into this stuff. Were you like, actually, what kind of music were you into prior to this?
All kinds of music. My dad, we had a musical house. My dad, mostly like just like fucking stoner butt rock, you know, but he had also like, you know, Miles Davis or like John Coltrane or classical stuff. And then just fucking, and then just, he had just, you know, probably had like 1,000 records, and it stretched the gamut of all different genres. But for the most part, it was just butt rock, you know, what my dad was into, like, you know, late 60s, early 70s, just beer drinking, cigarette smoking, party rock. Mm-hmm. But so what happened was, is I got the Dead Boys. I listened to the Dead Boys and it fucking blew me away. And then actually before I got the Dead Boys cassette and after I had seen the Tubes on TV, I heard the B-52s on the radio and the Ramones. And this is probably like 78. Mm. I heard the Ramones, Beat on the Brat. And I was like, what the fuck is this? They're talking about beating a kid with a baseball bat? Whoa, this is fucking gnarly. This is weird. So it piqued my interest a little more. Then fast forward, I got the Dead Boys. started listening to the Dead Boys. I had the Ramones and the B-52s on my radar. And what happened is I was in eighth grade in middle school, and this guy named Lee moved in, like just fucking kind of scary, edgy, looked different than everybody else. Like it was stocky, strong, kind of looked like a little man, even though we're like 14 years old. And he was into punk rock, and he started playing like real punk for me. Like, you know, not real punk, not that that wasn't real punk, but like diving into the LA scene, you know, with the Alley Cats and the Germs and you know, all these like LA bands. And so Lee and I became pretty good friends. He was quite a psychopath. So in between him getting suspended for fighting or smoking cigarettes, we would hang out, and it just opened the door. It just opened the door. So then, you know, I just started going to shows, and, you know, and then I just started meeting people. And then, you know, this is like in 1981 now. And, it just spoke to me, man. I finally had something that I felt like was mine. I belonged to something that was, you know, like a secret society of misfits, and it had this violent air about it, and this pent up aggression that spoke to me, because that's kind of like the household that I came from, and it gave me an outlet, you know. It meant the world to me, you know. I would sit in my room and just listen to music for hours, and just dissecting these bands and the lyrics, and, you know, probably what a lot of kids, the same journey as a lot of kids.
Absolutely. Well, going back to Lee, like, where'd you think Lee was getting into this stuff? Because you're pretty young and this stuff's pretty obscure at the time, right?
Lee was from, he moved up to where I was living. I was 20 minutes out of LA. I mean, out of Hollywood, about 10 minutes north of downtown LA, in this little suburb called Glendale. And Lee was from Lakewood. Lakewood is a suburb of Long Beach, which is South LA. Long Beach is a big fucking, it's a different beast. It's a different animal. And actually, that's where I've been living now for the last 30 years, is Long Beach. But it was less isolated than Glendale. So there was more of the surf scene and the skate scene and all that kind of stuff, which kind of lent itself to the punk rock scene. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and it wasn't far from Hermosa Beach, where a lot of like 70s punk rock was coming from. You know, so it was less isolated. So that's how he got into it. And then he brought it up to me. So to speak. It was already on my radar, but he helped me dive into it.
And who were some of the first bands, like, other than the Alley Cats, I guess, that were kind of, you were drawn to?
Oh, man. I really liked Red Cross, mm-hmm. even though they were kind of goofy and sticky. Fuck. You know, it's... Fear was one of my all-time favorites, and seeing them back then was just fucking out of control.
That must have been insane.
Yeah, it was. I'm kind of drawing a blank, to be honest with you. I mean, we're talking like 40 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like who was on my rotation, you know? But, you know, every, I think, Sunday night, there was a radio show called Rodney on the Rock from this guy named Rodney Bingenheimer. Mm-hmm. And he, I don't know, it was from like, I don't know, 10 to midnight. And he would play like local LA punk bands and stuff like that. And it was fucking goddamn badass.
And so going from like the stuff you had been into to going to these shows, like what were some of the first bands you went and saw?
The first band I went and saw was China White and Shattered Faith at this club called Godzilla's in 1981. And, you know, I saw a bunch of fucking really, like when people go like, what bands did you see? And I rattle them off. They're like, no fucking way. But, yeah, I mean, L.A. had this, like, revolving doors of the same bands playing different clubs. Like, you know, you can go see Circle Jerks, you can go see Bad Religion, you can go see Fear. You know, like, there was, like, these handfuls of clubs. The Vex, the Whiskey. Fuck, I'm drawing blanks. Hong Kong was a little bit before me. Mm-hmm. Then that's... But like the vet, there was three different Vexes. There was Whiskey. There was this place called Bard's Apollo. There was the Cafe de Grand came in a little bit later on, like more like 82.
Okay.
you know, but there was all these places. Oh, like there's Ukrainian Cultural Center. There was these little halls that would put shows on, and it was just going off.
Mm-hmm. It feels like that's also more of like, I guess, what would have been the second wave of stuff that was coming in, like when hardcore was kind of like had taken over.
Yes, that's exactly it. Like there was the first wave of like 70s punk rock that was more on the artsy fartsy kind of side of things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then probably starting in about 79, even though I wasn't going to shows in 79 and or any, you know, I was 79, I was 13 years old. There was an aggressive, more scary element coming in. The songs were faster, and there were more fuck you in your face, and there's more fighting and more drinking and more just like being a fucking delinquent, mm-hmm. you know? And that's what spoke to me. I don't know why, just getting out this fucking aggression and getting and just not knowing if the venue is going to explode or not, you know?
Mm-hmm. You also hear, you know, and it's also been kind of made story of and legend of the violence that's been going on. You guys definitely talk about it in the book. More in Mike's chapter, I find that he talks about like a lot of the violence that he kind of witnessed and stuff at those shows. Like, do you think a lot of that stuff's been, you know, has been almost glorified at this point?
Well, okay. Like when I first started going to shows, there was violence, but it was more random. Like the pit was violent. You know, it just had this violent aspect of it. But then within a year or two, these gangs started emerging, you know, and they brought an element of like thuggery. Like, you know, they would walk around in groups of five or six and they would just jump people for no reason. And then those people would like, you know, click up with another gang and then there'd be gang fights. So it started off as just individuals just kind of fucking freaking out and partying. And, you know, you're always going to have the guy that wants to be the biggest and the baddest and there would be individual fights or... You know, the random, like, you know, I got socked up a few times just randomly, but there wasn't this like prison element of it. That started coming around in about 83, 84, 85. There was this really strong presence of gangs, like legitimate gangs that would not fuck around, man. I mean, it made it even scarier, but it wasn't the same angst that drew me to it. It wasn't the same just like teenage rebellious kids trying to fucking, you know, let out some aggression. This was just straight up fucking assholes wanting to hurt people and no other reason. And the only reason they were at the punk shows was to hurt people. It's not that they were fans of the music. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. That was secondary. They were there to fucking be assholes.
Yes, because you hear about the gangs now, but you don't really hear about, you know, as many band members being involved in them. Like, certainly there's some bands that kind of get brought up in those conversations, but it's not like, it seems like it was almost a separate world from the music, like you're describing.
It was. I mean, there was a band called Circle One, and Circle One had a gang, and their leader was named John Macias, and John Macias was the singer of Circle One, and they were some of those fucking assholes.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it was... just guys there just to be fucking dicks, you know?
Yeah.
It's just disenfranchised, suburban kids that maybe had, I don't know, man. I mean, most of those people, I knew a lot of them, and Mike knew a lot of them. A lot of them are dead or in and out of prisons now for the rest of their lives, because that's the path that they set themselves up on. You know, at 18 years old, they would get arrested fighting, and then they would get arrested again with a gun, and then it just progressively got worse and worse and worse. You know, there was... 100% stabbings and guns involved and drive-bys. And it's so weird because it was just punk rock. That's what it was. It wasn't like you grew up in some shitty neighborhood where you're trying to defend your turf so you could sell your drugs. It was these groups of guys would go to a show just to fight another group of guys or whoever else was in the way.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like at a certain point that almost kills off like punk rock in LA, like in the mid, like where the late 80s, I guess, like, you know, with the exception of, you know, Bad Religion and L7 and kind of these other bands, like kind of rebuilding it, like it feels like it kind of drops off.
It does. I think that I'm not sure if that killed it. I'm not sure what, maybe the newness of punk rock had worn off. So kids discovering it weren't as excited, you know. There was also the metal wave where a lot of bands were kind of like swinging towards the thrash metal or punk metal kind of vibe, you know? I think maybe just, like, you know, in 81, 82, it was still pretty fucking new, so a lot of people felt the same way I did. They were just discovering it, and they're like, oh my God, this is rad. But then fast forward 5, 6, 7 years, there's no longer that newness, and, you know, maybe there's something else that got the kids' attention.
So I guess going back to before that time, definitely, like, how did you start playing in bands?
When I was about 14 and I started listening to punk rock, Lee, my friend Lee, played guitar. And then we met a couple other kids from the area. There's a guy named, we called him Flipper, from after the band Flipper. And this guy named Dan Bottrell. And Dan Bottrell was probably 2 or 3 years older than me. We all kind of met. We were from the same area. We had same taste of music. We're like, hey, let's start a band. I'm like, all right, cool, whatever, let's start a band. And I'd always been into music, and I'd always wanted to play music. So Lee played guitar, Dan played guitar, and Flipper said, I want to play bass. And then I was like, well, then I guess the only instrument left is drums. So at about 14 years old, I started playing drums. I bought a drum set for $200. It was a little piece of shit Rogers. And started playing drums and right away picked it up right away. And within a year, I was playing in Costa Cause. And those guys were in their 30s. They could really play. Like, they'd been playing since they were kids, I guess, or teenagers. And so I picked it up fast enough to where I was playing shows, like legitimate shows, within a year.
So do you play on those recordings, like that are on We Got the Party and Party Animal?
Yeah.
Oh, those songs are so awesome.
Actually, the first one, I'm not sure if that's me or not. I'm not sure if that was because I did a bunch of Mystic recordings with Caustic Cause. I don't know if that's me or not. I know that I had recorded because it was so long ago, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, definitely. And then there was like a few other, I think there was a couple other comps that Caustic Cause came out on around the same time.
I know there's like the only three songs that I know of that came out are, there's the one on the We Got the Power comp,
right?
Which is Look to the Left.
Look to the Left. That was me.
Okay. That song rips. And then Our Backyard, which comes out later on Party Animal in 84.
I think that was me. That was me as well.
And then
Look to the Left kind of starts off with like a jungle beat, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That was me.
Oh, that's awesome. And then Experiment in Terror came out years later on a Roger Murray benefit compilation that Grand Theft Auto put out. Audio
that comedy. I don't know. I don't remember that name. What year did that come out?
That came out in 95.
That was definitely not me.
But I think it's definitely an old recording, and it's like a surf song with a sax.
Oh shit, that was me. Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah. I guess you're owed some royalties, but they went to Roger Murray's legal defense fund, allegedly, according to this comp's liner notes, which I actually bought in 1995. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, our sax player's name was Kip, I think. Or no, was that one of the guitar players? Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing about Caustic Cause is like we did like the typical LA punk rock, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then there's also a bunch of surf songs. But, like, those guys could play.
So are there more, like, there must be more songs out there that are recorded then, right?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I probably recorded 10 songs with them. I'm just throwing the number out there because we did like 3 or 4 sessions at Mystic Studios, mm-hmm. you know, and you figure a couple songs a session, you know? So yeah, I would guess, but I don't really know.
It's like,
I mean, I literally haven't talked to those guys since 1983.
Mm-hmm. I think it's amazing to kind of think of the treasures that are held in those vaults at Mystic's record studio or wherever Doug Moody is now. I believe he's still alive too.
I don't really know. I know that like a few years ago when he was putting out our stuff, he was living at his mom's house. Not to say that his mom was alive or dead, but I mean, pretty sad when you're like in your 70s living at your mom's house.
Well, it's actually like I just had Tony from the band Municipal Waste on the podcast the other day, and he at one point was going to do a zine about record labels and interviewed Doug Moody for it. And he forwarded the email responses from Doug Moody to his questions. And he, at the time, and this is like 8 years ago, said he was 81 years old.
Jesus Christ.
Do you remember meeting him for the first time?
You know, I actually don't. I don't because Mystic Studios was literally a half a block away from Café de Grand.
Okay.
And, yes. And so, and Café de Grand had shows 5 nights a week. Or if there was a show, people were hanging out. It was like the hub. So I would take the bus in, you know, or I would get a ride in. It would just park myself there. And I knew everybody, and everybody knew everybody. And you stayed away from the gangsters, and, you know, and you, and you know, you just hung out. And so I had been in and out of Mystic Studios God knows how many times. It was literally a half a block away. So, you know, people would go over there, hey, let's go to Mystic and drink some beer or whatever. You go up there and hang out with Phil, or, you know, the Mentors might be recording a song, and you go up there and hang out with the Mentors, you know.
That's awesome. You know, I love that label. Like, I'm a huge nerd for it too. And like, there's just so much great stuff. Like, well, I think like the track listing on that Party Animal comp is a who's who of American hardcore, but just the LA bands, like America's Hardcore's on it, Justice League's on it. Like,
yeah.
It's so like, did Caustic Cause ever get out of playing in LA area?
No. We'd just play at LA, Pasadena, Burbank, West Hollywood. You know, no.
It going back to, you know, those early kind of days, did you play with Justice League and America's Hardcore?
Yeah, a whole bunch.
So were they kind of more part of your scene? Like, how did Caustic Cause kind of fit in? Like, what were the bands that were kind of part of the scene that you were part of?
Okay, well, Caustic Cause was prior to that, like, straight edge thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or that LA hard, like America's Hardcore and Justice League. It was before that. And then what America's Hardcore and Justice League all started about the same time NoFX started. Justice League was a couple years prior to that. I mean, not just Caustic Cause was a couple years prior to that. So Caustic Cause would just play random shows with random bands. We would play like, you know, with some punk bands, or we would play like the fucking, you know, some venue and, you know, some weird place with nobody there, you know, it, cause they were just playing to play shows, you know. NoFX started, and they weren't really connected with the LA. I mean, okay, how can I explain this? They were older guys. They were in their 30s, you know, like 32, 33 years old. I'm 15. So they would just play wherever. When I got into NoFX, being 16, we became friends with like a lot of other bands that were like 16 years old. So we would make these packages and play these shows together. Caustic Cause was just playing wherever, whenever.
Okay.
So when NoFX started playing, we would say, hey, let's play Roxanne's on Tuesday night. Who do you want to get to play with? You know, and then we'd call up so-and-so and have like little packages.
Yeah, much more of a scene, I guess.
Right. And Caustic Cause was just playing, and I was just, it was my first band playing out. So playing anywhere, playing in, you know, the Music Machine in Santa Monica in front of four people on a Tuesday night at 7:30 was fucking phenomenal.
Yeah. But like, so those guys were just like older dudes that just got into hardcore. Cause it sounds like a bunch of young kids playing like ripping hardcore.
Yeah. They were older. You know, like, I think they were probably butt rockers in the early 70s.
Yeah.
You know, and then they discovered punk rock in the mid 70s. Like, fuck yeah, this punk rock shit's kind of fucking badass. And then, you know, they started Caustic Cause like in 81. I was the second drummer. So maybe they started Caustic Cause in 80. I'm not sure. So I think they, they were like ripping guitar players, like fucking good. So they came from like the rock and roll world, discovered punk rock, liked it, played punk rock, and with tinges of other styles of music. I don't think they were ever like punk rock for life kind of attitude, you know? They were just playing it because they liked it.
Totally. And I guess like, you know, NoFX forms, like, you know, the infamous story of them recruiting you to be in the band. Do you remember meeting Don Bowles for the first time? Like, had you met him before?
I'd seen him around at shows. I think the first time I met him was the day before we recorded the our first demo. I met him at, I forget exactly, but I was the one that said, hey man, you want to come do our record or produce our, and he was like, fuck yeah, cool. You needed a couple bucks. So he came over and did it.
And like, I guess he had been playing in Vox Pop probably around then.
Yeah. That was about Vox Pop 45 Grave.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
He was in 45 Grave. That was another great fucking LA band.
Incredible band.
Yeah. God, what was her name? Oh, Diana Cancer. Yeah, 45 Grave. They were fucking good. That brings back like you know all these comps like Hell Comes to Your House. And have you heard that one?
I love that comp.
Okay, that was like in 81-ish probably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was like those bands are like my anthem. So you say, what bands did I see back then? And I say, I'm drawing a blank. Just go off of that.
So one band that I am obsessed with off that comp is that band Modern Warfare.
Oh, God, I remember them, but I don't remember the song.
Their song on that comp is like not nearly as good. They have two singles, and the second single is just ripping. One of my old bands covered it. It's just like one of the best kind of raging LA punk scene. The vocals just like are just so over the top. He's like seething the words out as he's screaming.
God, you are like the ultimate punk nerd.
I tell, well, this is what, like, actually, I remember meeting you again subsequently all those years later after I was in Fucked Up backstage at a show, and just, you know, you have your separate section of the NoFX backstage. I believe it's still set up like this.
And yeah, stay away from the fucking hooligans. I just want to relax and watch my Netflix.
Yeah, and you allowed me to have kind of company with you, and I just punished the shit out of you. And I had a lot more limited knowledge back then. So guess what? I've been boning up.
Yeah, you haven't. You've been studying. Okay, here's a little interesting tidbit. Okay, remember that band, America's Hardcore? You brought them up.
Yes.
The guitar player's name was Drew Bernstein.
Mm-hmm.
And he went on to play Crucifix for a little bit.
I know the intro to Annihilation off by heart.
Oh, fuck. That record is fucking gnarly.
Oh, so good.
Dude, that is blow your face off from start to finish. So he went into playing Crucifix, and then he started a clothing line. I just found out yesterday that he shot himself like 5 years ago or something. Killed himself.
I remember hearing it around the time that he had passed away. Really tragic.
I didn't know that. I was fucking around on Instagram, and I came across some like old punk rock page, you know, old pictures. And there was a picture of him playing it, and it said, Drew Bernstein, America's Hardcore or whatever. Another one gone too soon. And I was like, what? And then so I Googled it, and he killed himself like in, I don't know, 2014 or something.
I remember meeting a guy, Sean, who ran a clothing company called Rockers NYC, who claimed that he was actually a roadie for NoFX at some point early on.
Sean, and
he was taught to silkscreen by Drew. Mike, when he was on the podcast, denied that this guy Sean ever roadied for NoFX, but he was taught how to silkscreen and kind of like brought into the clothing world by Drew.
Dude, it's kind of weird. Like that guy at 21. I mean, I know people don't really understand. Know what's going on? It's kind of boring, probably.
No, this is what the show's about, dude. Don't worry. Yeah.
At 21, he had lip service going, and it was fucking raging. 21, you're a fucking kid, man. You still get pimples on your face.
No, it's, they are like a legendary band. You know the movie Made with Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau?
Yeah.
In the opening sequence of that movie, they're driving down the street, and Vince Vaughn's wearing the America's Hardcore shirt.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because I guess someone else from the band wound up working in film. I guess a couple people from the band actually wound up working in film. And one of them worked on the set. And even if you listen to the audio commentary for the DVD of Made, this is how nerdy I am. Vince Vaughn brings up the shirt and is like, actually, that shirt I'm wearing is of a punk band from the area called America's Hardcore.
Vince Vaughn knew that?
Well, I'm sure he was fed the line. He must have been, right? Like, I follow these trends and I follow these things, and I've never heard that he was a punk, but who knows?
Yeah. Wow, you know who was a punk was Jon Stewart.
I've heard that. Definitely.
He was in a punk band, and then Josh Brolin was a punk?
Yes, Josh Brolin was in the pre-Rich Kids on LSD band.
No, he was not.
Yes, he was. I swear to God, he was.
Who told you that?
I brought it up to Joey Cape when he was on the podcast.
Was he in, what was it called, Section 8? Or no,
It's not Section 8. It's like some other, like, I forget what they're called, like not Thalidomide Babies, because obviously, but it's like something like that. And
dude, that was one of NoFX's first songs, Thalidomide Child.
Yeah, Thalidomide Child. And I think this might be something like that. I'm trying to remember now, but Josh Brolin was the drummer, and apparently some of the dudes wound up being in Rich Kids on LSD.
Wow.
I tell you. Also, weirdly, Michael Ian Black, you know, from Wet Hot American Summer and all those movies.
Do not.
Okay. He was in a band with Tim Shaw from Ensign, which is a shocking one for me.
Interesting. But I don't know who that guy is. I don't know what those shows are.
I'll send you a link. But anyway, back to this trip. back to this journey. Also on that comp, Scared Straight was another band that, you know, wound up becoming part of, like, you know, 10 Foot Pole and ultimately Pulley. So it's amazing how many of these people that will wind up kind of just graduating on, like yourself included, obviously, to be the next wave of bands and ultimately kind of take over punk rock.
Yeah. Like Scared Straight, they kind of fell in about the same time NoFX started with Justice League and all that kind of shit. There was like this LA straight edge movement that was kind of like the second wave of straight edge. There was the East Coast straight edge and there's LA straight edge movement. NoFX was never straight edge, but we were about the same age. You know, we're all about the same age. We all kind of started around the same time. So it was like there was some camaraderie there, mm-hmm. you know. So we would play a lot of shows with those bands.
And was it like, was this scene less violent generally?
The smaller shows, you know, LA had like these huge shows, like at the Palladium and the Olympic, where there's 3,000-4,000 people there, you know, or at like SIR Studios that had like 1,500 people there, you know, like big halls or big venues. These shows that we did with these other bands were just in small little clubs. So the asshole element either didn't know about these shows because it was on such a smaller level, or they didn't want to go because there wouldn't be too many people to fuck with. You know?
Yeah.
Like I said, they weren't there. They weren't there for the music. They were there to be assholes. So they, like, I would go to fucking party and play music and hang out with my friends. Those other guys would go to fucking kick the shit out of people.
Mm, totally. Well, I guess moving on from that, like once NoFX starts, you know, really getting going and, you know, touring and stuff like that, what were the early shows and that you were playing on those first tours? Like what kind of bands were you playing with? Like, I mean, pre, you know, the scene that you ultimately inspire popping up, like where did NoFX fit in?
Well, I know that our first out of town show ever, like we probably played 30 shows in LA, mm-hmm. right? We started in 83 and I think our first tour was in 84. I could be wrong about the year, but it was, we set up a little West Coast deal. We were a bunch of little 17-year-old kids and we got in Eric Belvin's parents' station wagon and just went. And our first out of town show was in Reno with 7 Seconds. And that was like the equivalent of like some garage metal band opening up for Iron Maiden at the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, like 7 Seconds was a pretty fucking good band. They had worldwide popularity and we're playing their hometown.
Yeah.
And, you know, in most of our shows in LA were in front of literally a handful of people, or we played a bunch of parties, you know, in front of a handful of people. There's probably 200 people at this show. So it was like playing in front of a fucking stadium, yeah. You know? So it was badass. So we did this little West Coast run and we just, every town we played in, we just kind of played with local bands, you know, and we were so bad, like literally bad, that we didn't sound like anything. We didn't really have a genre. I mean, we had a genre as punk rock, but we just sound like a bunch of kids fucking twanking away, you know? So we didn't really fit in with like any one band in particular.
Well, also, you had a mic stand, too, which I think probably, you know, prevents, like, you know, 7 Seconds. I guess Kevin was probably just on, you know, on the mic, right? He wasn't doing guitar.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly. I don't remember. You know, as weird as my drumming, like, I picked it up really quick. And like I said, within a year, I'm playing with guys that could really play. Mm-hmm. When I quit Costa Cause in, I don't know, 83 to join NoFX. Since those guys, since Mike and Melvin were just beginning to learn how to play, my drumming got so bad so quick because you rise to the occasion. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like I was playing with guys that understood music and understood tempo and understood like dynamics, and Mike and Melvin didn't even know how to fucking tune. So I went from being like a decent drummer at, you know, 2 years in to like fucking being a full blown beginner. And I didn't even ever realize that until way after the fact.
No, it it's funny too, because like the NoFX records early on, like I love them and they've got like a certain charm to them. But like you're saying, it's just like it nowhere betrays the band that you would become, except like the drumming does. Like, you know, you're never a bad drummer.
I don't know. The Liberal Animation record, I drummed pretty bad because that's when Bomber from RKL was kicking ass, and I really wanted to emulate him. Mm-hmm. And there's no way anybody can emulate him. So what it did is it sidetracked me from what I was good at and showcased what I was bad at.
I could definitely see, like, I still love that record though. And I finally tracked down like a first press of it with the red on black impossible to read cover.
Yeah. Here's a little, okay. You read the book, right? You know, that guy, Raymond.
Yeah.
Psychopath. He drew that album cover.
Really?
Yes. And Raymond's real name is Ryan, and you can see it.
I was going to say, cause even on the audiobook, you still refer to him as Raymond. Is he like around?
He's in prison for life. But when we were doing the book, he was out and I didn't want to give him any recourse or whatever, you know. He was a lot like that guy from, Robert De Niro from that Cape Fear. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, he just had a way of fucking with, like, I could come home from 7-Eleven one day and he'd just be sitting in my living room watching TV, talking to my wife. And I'd be like, oh fuck. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was out of prison at the time, even though he'd spent most of his life in prison when we were doing that book. And I just didn't want to give him anything, you know?
So was he someone from the punk hardcore scene?
He was one of those guys that gravitated towards it because of the violence.
Yeah.
You know, like, he had spent most of his teen years in prison. And when he got out, when RKL was kicking out, because he was from Santa Barbara. Is when RKL and all that shit was going on, and then he gravitated towards it because of the violence.
So the RKL scene must have been pretty heavy.
Meaning what?
Like when Mike was on the show, he described it as the only band in history that had a pimp and a prostitute in the band at the same time. And like, it just seems from like what you're describing, like the people that are gravitating towards it because of the popularity and because it's raging, seems to be like a heavy kind of crowd.
What Mike's talking about was in the later years of RKL, like in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. You know, even later, you know, like when they went to Epitaph. Mm-hmm. When I moved to Santa Barbara in 85, and I got to know all those guys really well because Santa Barbara's a small town, and they were just skater party guys. You know what I mean? Like, Santa Barbara's a weird town. It's like there's a lot of money and a lot of really super rich kids, and then there's a lot of just average kids. And when those two mix, it just is a recipe for disaster for some weird reason. So what it was all these fucking surfer kids that had, a lot of them had way too much money and a lot of them had way too much time. And it was just a big fucking party scene. You know, what Mike's talking about is like years later when that party scene actually turns into a very fucking detrimental lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it all catches up eventually.
Right. Right.
I guess going back to when it was, you know, before that time, do you remember the first time you ever saw RKL live?
Yeah, I do, actually. It wasn't at a show. It was when they were recording their first single at Mystic Studios. Remember, like I said, you'd go over to Mystic and hang out.
Yeah.
I walked in there and RKL was doing their very first single, and this is probably 83.
Yeah, it is 83. That single, yeah, okay, fucking rips.
And I remember watching Bomber play drums through the glass, and I had never heard of RKL because they're from 100 miles away. You know, there was no internet, yeah, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck am I listening to? What the fuck is he playing? And that was my introduction to RKL.
One of the best bands ever. And actually, recently, I picked up a copy of Keep Laughing, a reissue autographed by Doug Moody.
Oh shit. He autographed it.
He autographed it. And he did, I guess he did 300 of them because it's numbered out of 300, but it's signed by Doug Moody with a little sparkly star sticker beside his signature.
That is so fucking funny.
It's so weird.
That is so weird.
I had to buy it though, cause I was like, it's so weird. Like, how could I not purchase this thing?
All right. So how much was it?
Oh, it was like $10.
Oh, okay. No big deal.
And it's also like my third copy of Keep Laughing too. Like, I really did not need it, but I couldn't say no.
Couldn't say no to Doug Moody's sparkly face.
Could not say no to Doug Moody's, you know, to think about him at 70, you know, some odd years old, sitting at his parents' place doing these records. Like, man, this guy, you know, allegedly worked with Pink Floyd, right? Or Led Zeppelin.
Led Zeppelin. Supposedly, I mean, I don't know. The rumor has it that the board that we all recorded off of Led Zeppelin used on their first couple records.
It's amazing how different it sounds on the Mystic recordings than it sounds on those early Led Zeppelin records.
Yeah, because It's just because you got a board doesn't mean the band's going to sound fucking awesome. You know, and Phil, the guy Phil that was recording, I don't think spent too much time on fucking worrying about shit. He was just like, all right, what Mystic Studios was, and was a puppy mill for shitty teenage punk bands. Bring them in, you'd fucking breed and make a bunch of fucking shitty little fucking puppy punk songs and kick them out and then bring in the next fucking band.
But it's funny because, like, you know, you think about all that stuff that he recorded, like, none of it's commercial. Like, it's not like the guy that was, like, putting together all the boy bands in the 90s, like, trying to get hits to make money. Like, what do you think his end game was other than just recording bands?
That's a good point. I mean, like, you know, I bet you our first single we sold in the first 5 years, maybe 1,000 copies. You know what I mean? And there's no money in that.
Yeah. Like, and also, like, you know, like, I imagine, thank God for NoFX, because I can imagine all those Best of NoFX, Max Rock and Roll CDs probably kept that dude afloat for years and years.
Absolutely.
Afterwards.
Absolutely. Like, you know, like, when we started gaining traction as a band, like in, I don't know, 92 or something like that, 93, 92, like when it started really working, then all of a sudden we started seeing remixes and remakes and compilations, you know, like, that Mystic was just with us. And it was like, whoa, what the fuck? And I'm sure, you know, he did pretty good off of that for a minute.
Oh, I'm sure he did. I guarantee he did, because I certainly bought a couple copies myself. But it's also, the Stern Brothers were on the show and tell the story about when they were recording there and went down and shook him down with the guys from Regression for the tapes.
Oh, shit. Those guys were scary looking, too.
Yeah. And then they kind of blame that incident, though, for hooking him up with all the hardcore bands. They're like, if we hadn't done that, he probably would never met the Aggression guys. It probably would never gone down that road.
Oh, good point, man. So how's that? They go shake him down with Aggression, and then Aggression gets a record deal.
Aggression got a record deal out of it. I guess, you know, Doug Moody saw paychecks walking in the door with those guys or something.
Well, there was a bunch. I mean, there was a bunch of little record labels. Like, there was Posh Boy, mm-hmm. and there was a couple other ones. But I mean, Posh Boy actually had some quality bands, and you could see that it would sell, you know. When Mystic was coming out, they were just firing stuff out so much that even if there was something good, it got lost in the shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's amazing how long it kept going and how early it starts, too.
When did Mystic start? 81, 82?
No, it starts in the 70s.
With who?
It starts in like 78 with like a bunch of like novelty records, like, and a bunch of weird disco records. And actually, one of the first punk records they put out is the band Hey Taxi, which is the drummer of the Minutemen's band he did before he joined the Minutemen.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
But like, yeah, it starts like really early on and goes right until, like, I think, well, obviously, thanks to you guys, right into the late 90s.
Huh. Yeah, I had no idea it started that. I mean, the first I ever remember hearing of Mystic was probably like Mentors and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they're really early too, and Vox Pop is super early as well,
and
stuff like that. But I guess it's like Aggression, Ill Repute, and all the hardcore bands that where it really gets kind of, you know, churning out those releases.
They probably sold pretty good with the Aggression and the Ill Repute. It was the wave immediately after that of all the little singles that they put out. That was probably just, you know, he was just clamoring to keep it alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Another big band I wanted to ask you about, because you guys cover them, is the Neos. Do you remember first hearing the Neos?
No, I don't. That was Mike. Mike was, they were East Coast, right?
No, they're from Vancouver, Victoria, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Mike was into all these bands outside of LA, and he would present stuff to us. Like, you know, we recorded a song by this band called Impact Unit.
Yeah.
Which was Dickie Barrett's first punk band, you know, and Mike. I think I could be wrong, but I think Mike was like kind of pen pally with people in bands, and they would send music back and forth. So if we recorded a Neo song or did a Neo's classic, it's because Mike brought it to the table. Yeah, I didn't really know much of that shit.
Later on, when you become part of the Dog Patch Winos, like, what kind of music was involved in that? Like, I know it was mainly like a party gang, but did it have any sort of, you know, musical affiliation?
With the Winos?
Yeah.
There wasn't really any bands associated with it. What we were, though, was okay, this is kind of where it gets back into the gang territory. Dog Patch Winos were a little bit of a faction off of the Lads, the Los Angeles Death Squad. Mm-hmm. And we were, the Lads were a bunch of badass motherfuckers. The Dog Patch Winos were just a bunch of fucking drunken, stupid idiots, you know, kind of like the fucking, Gilligan from Gilligan's Island, you know, it's, you know, hanging out with a fucking bunch of Nazis, even though, wait, I take that back. Lads aren't a bunch of Nazis. They're very mixed race. But what I'm saying is the degree of anger. Mm-hmm. So there weren't really any bands associated with the Winos, unless it was us at the time, you know, but, yeah, we were just a bunch of fucking just drunken idiots. And, you know, we'd get in our fights and get in our little scraps and all this kind of shit. But we were just drunken idiots.
So, yeah, once again, it was something that was kind of completely removed from the music side of things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, punk rock was our thing. Like, that's what we all came from. But it was just like, and we gravitated towards punk rock. But it was just like, it. You know what it was? As cheesy as it sounds, it was a bunch of guys looking for some solidarity, some brotherhood, for a fraternity of sorts. You know what I mean? Like, you have jocks, you have fraternities, you have these clubs where you feel a part of something, mm-hmm. and it feels special. The same reason why when I got into punk rock, I felt a part of something and I felt special. When I got jumped into the Winos, I felt like a part of something inside of something. Like, it makes you feel special about yourself. And what it is, it's just insecurity and looking for validation.
And was it something you actually had to be jumped into?
I had to headbutt John Brandon, the leader and the starter of Dog Patch Winos. I have no fucking idea how many times we headbutted each other until he said, okay, you're good. I remember it too, dude. It fucking hurt.
I can't even begin to imagine. That sounds pretty severe.
Yeah, because he's trying to headbutt me to get me to back down. And I'm trying to headbutt him to not back down, you know, and it yeah. fucking was stupid.
Well, it's like Rams. It's like when you see those Rams just yes. bashing skulls together.
Yes. Fuck. It hurt. But then you can't let on that it hurt.
Yeah. No, you can't at all. I guess, like, in the book, you talk about what, you know, the feeling of when, you know, you come back from that first tour and you each had made $10,000 each. And obviously you were dealing.
That was the first tour in your, no, that was. That was our third tour in Europe, but it was the first tour we ever made money.
Yeah, sorry, the first tour you ever made money on when you came right. back with that much money. At that point, was it like, you know, obviously you're still wrestling with drug issues, but, you know, in a major way, you're dealing with drug issues. I didn't mean to diminish it, but
yeah. No.
At the same time, like, all this stuff is kind of happening as far as the music stuff goes. Were you able to kind of take in that part of the experience, like, and like, at all, or were you...
No, yeah, of course, man. Like, the band was booming. Punk rock was booming. I mean, fuck yeah. I felt the pride and I felt the swell of the music and I felt the wave of all of that. But, you know, I mean, I was also tormented by heroin, yeah. you know. But, yeah, I knew that we were on the cusp of something special, for sure. You know, I remember, there was one night when we played in someplace in Germany. I think we talk about it in the book. Where we actually made $10,000 at a show. Yeah. Like, we had 5 years earlier, no, a year earlier, we were playing for $30. You know, it was the combined of the door and our merchandise. And it was like, maybe 1,000 people at the show. It was like, what the fuck? And it was like, not to make it about money, but it was like, are you fucking kidding me? What the fuck? And we all went to the bar and bought drinks for everybody and raging. Just, it was out of control. It was the weirdest feeling. It was like if you won the lottery.
Who were you playing with in Europe at that time? Like, on even the time before, was it mainly like American bands going over or like that? I know you did that split with Drowning Roses.
Right. The first time we went over with Drowning Roses, I think the second time we went over with this band Happy Hour, which was David Pollock from Destiny Records band.
Okay.
And maybe the third time too, but we were just playing with whoever, like, you know, we were just in a van driving and whoever was there, like, you know, sometimes it would be another band from the United States. Most of the time it was just local German bands, mm-hmm. you know, it was not a package deal or anything. We were just driving and playing halls, little venues, you know, auditoriums, shit like that.
Yeah. And it's a Destiny Records kind of scene, like No Allegiance and all those bands, I guess.
Yeah. No Allegiance was David Pollock's first band.
Okay.
And then, but yeah, but we were just playing with whoever, whatever. And I remember at the time too, a lot of German bands would show up without equipment, you know, and they're like, hello, not effects. We are here to play. We are opening up for you. Where is the drum set? And we're like, what the fuck are you talking about? you've known you've had this show for 9 months. And you don't have a drum set. And they would get pissed off. Hey, hold on. My dog's trying to help my leg. Off. Stop. And then, they would get pissed off. I'm like, dude, what happens if you break my fucking kick drum pedal? And then we got to play.
Yeah.
You know? So that's what it was. It was still very grassroots. It was still very small, you know?
It's funny because it felt like that. It was like that when the first time we went to England, where we're touring and we're the backline company coming to play a show. And it's like, wait, we don't live here. Like,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know? So, yeah, it was still very small and it was still very grassroots and it was still DIY. I mean, there's still shows where there's 15 people there. And then every once in a while, there'd be a show where there's 500 people there. But for the, I think we were out there for that tour where we made the $10,000. I'm going to say close to 3 months.
Wow.
And it was maybe two, but it was a long fucking time. So if you divide, you know, let's say it was 2 months. Let's say we played 45 shows in 2 months. You know, we made a couple hundred bucks a show.
Were you playing all Germany too at that time? Were you going over the UK at all? Or
I know that. I mean, we would do like Italy and Spain and Austria and Switzerland, and we even tried to go to Yugoslavia before it was, you know, before the revolt. Yeah, I'm gonna say we went to the UK.
Okay, so it wouldn't be 45 days in Germany.
No. It was continental Europe.
Okay. So, like, I guess, like, was there a moment where you felt like where this music was catching on? Like, I know Nevermind is brought up a lot in the book by various people, but like, do you remember a time where you're like, oh, geez, these shows are changing? Like, the type of people that are coming out aren't necessarily, you know, the same old punks.
No, I don't actually. I mean, maybe because I'm so far removed, you know, we're 30 years from them, from then. But I mean, there was definitely there was at some point a changing in the guard to where it wasn't like, where it was more mainstream. Yeah, I guess so. I guess like with the Green Day and the Blink and all that. No, not Blink. Green Day and the hit of the Offspring, it became way more mainstream. And there wasn't this, okay, when I got into punk rock, you were either punk rock or you weren't. And if you showed up at a show with long hair and a fucking Led Zeppelin t-shirt, you got fucked up. You got, your hair got cut. You got cut with a bottle. You know, there was this us against them mentality. And then fast forward 20 years later, or not even that, 10 years later, it was like, come one, come all. So there was definitely a big difference in the crowd.
That must have been a weird time too, because that's like around the time, like, I think it was Circus Magazine did a stolen interview with you guys where they posed as a fanzine and ran an interview with you because...
Oh, fuck. I didn't know. I don't know about this.
I remember this happening. Like, this also was pre-internet, so this could just be word of mouth rumor, but there was like an interview in like one of those big mainstream sort of like circus type, Hit Parader type magazine type things.
Right.
But then it turns out it was some guy that posed as a fanzine and then sold the interview to Circus.
Is that the one where Mike is talking shit about Henry Rollins?
I think so.
Okay. I kind of remember that. I didn't know the backstory of it, but I remember at one point Mike was like, I didn't fucking do this for this reason. And I'm not doing interviews now. You know, he was doing the Trump shit, fake news.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Eric, this has been amazing. And would you come back at some point in the future for a part two?
Absolutely. I mean, I hope I didn't bore everybody, and I hope that the story, you know, the there was some context and some fluidity and some linear, you know, verbiage, you know, the shit worked.
Well, if there wasn't, it's my fault. So don't take any blame yourself for that. But
before... A movie's only as good as its director.
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, we're dealing with, like, you know, the not the greatest. We're not dealing with Kubrick over here. But before I let you go, I did want to talk to you about kind of like what I kind of see is like a sonic leap forward that the band made kind of early on, which is the Longest Line EP, which just feels like, you know, obviously there's a new guitar player coming in and things like that. But it just feels like that was a point where you guys were kind of going to a different sound. Was that something that just kind of came out naturally, or is that?
Yeah, it wasn't by design. It wasn't like, oh, okay, now we need to change our sounds like this and that. Like, what it was is we were recording in the studio that Bad Religion had recorded their last two records on, you know, West Beach. Mm-hmm. We were using Brett and Donald, who it was just their recording technique. And we rented drums that were very good drums. It had very good sounds, you know, and it was just with the tools that were given to us by the studio. You know, it was nothing like we are physically trying to change the sound. And Steve is a very good guitar player, very good. And he started talking to us about tones. Like, you know, if you have a guitar tone, you know, we would just play loud and obnoxious and out of tune. He's like, look, guys, we got to stay in tune. We got to have a good guitar tone because you're only as good as you sound, you know? Mm-hmm. So there was that. But the progression of our sound wasn't on purpose. It was just with the tools that were given to us. And then we were able to, as we got a little more popular, buy better equipment to maintain that sound.
Oh, well, Eric, anytime you want to come back, the door is always open.
Well, thank you very much. I really, really, really stoked on this. And sorry it took so long. You know, the world's a weird place these days.
Thank you, Eric, for coming on the show. When you heard right there, he will be back for part two at some point in the future. I love seeing that dude. Since I was a kid, he's always been cool, always a nice smile. And I love seeing that guy every time I run into him backstage. And so hopefully I get to see him again soon. Speaking of soon, coming up very soon as we continue this NoFX week that we are on in celebration of the single album, which will be coming out very soon. Returning to the show, the most listened to episode ever, Fat Mike will be back for a part two. That's right. Mike is here. Completely different vibe from the first time he was on the show. This is a very different kind of interview. But don't worry, it's still combative. We still argue. He still thinks my taste in music sucks, and I still, you'll hear it. You'll hear it coming up later on the show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. As always, remember, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves. Go out of your way to get informed. Read articles from reputable sources. Don't go on, you know, there's lots of reputable sources and they're easy to figure out. Get informed about what's going on in the world right now. Donate, sign petitions, show up, be involved. Just basically talk to people around you. Just, you know, we got to get rid of fascism. That's basically the end game here. We're trying to get rid of this thing, this ugly monster that just keeps rearing its head every few years. So just smash it, smash fascism. And whenever you can, go out there and sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. You don't need them. Just dead weight, as we like to say around here. But no, seriously, please sign your organ donor cards and give blood if you can too. That's definitely very necessary right now. And also make something creative. Go out there and make your own culture, start a band, start a fanzine, start a podcast, do whatever you want to do. People hit me up all the time for advice on how to start a podcast. Just do it. It's so easy. If I can do it, anyone can do this shit. I promise you, anyone can do this shit. Wear a mask, stay safe, and I love you. And I'll see you next episode with Fat Mike, part two. Oh boy, it's a doozy. Thanks for listening.